Hello, welcome again to Sport Unlocked. It's been a few weeks. Thanks to all of those of you asking where we have been, but a pretty busy build up to the World Cup. And here we are in Qatar, at least myself, Rob Harris from Sky News and Tarek Panja from the New York Times. Unfortunately, back in England, Martin Ziegler from the Times. How are you viewing things in Qatar from afar?
Yeah, my Qatar trip lasted 24 hours before a family emergency dragged me back. But glad to say everything is okay on that front. It's strange watching it from here. There's a lot of anger, I think, about some of the FIFA decisions, famously around the armbands and some of the rainbow hats people have been prevented from wearing. So interesting to get your take. It seems to be very little response from FIFA or the Qatar 2022 to any sort of questions. There hasn't been any, apart from that Infantino press conference, which we'll talk about. There just hasn't been any access, has there, guys?
Yeah, so much to get into. Tarek, alongside me, how's your first week or so at the World Cup? I've been here for a couple of weeks. You've been here almost as long as well. We're actually speaking from the host city media centre, it's called, if there's a bit of noise around. How have you found it?
It's like going through a washing machine for me. It's just like this constant swirl of news. It feels like the most newsy sports event I've covered. And we've been doing this collectively probably for almost 60 years, if you add, 70 if we add Ziegs. but it's just been relentless news-wise, hasn't it? And then obviously the football's here as well. That said, we kind of expected it, Martin, didn't we, to be extremely newsy given the 12-year build-up?
Yeah, absolutely, because there's been so much controversy around how Qatar won the bid, what's happened in the 12 years since then in terms of migrant workers' rights, and all the sort of corruption allegations that have been swirling around. But yeah, no, just wanted to, how have you found getting answers to your questions from the football World Cup authorities, FIFA, Qatar? How's that been?
Well, that's one of the things that's been noteworthy, the silence at times. So if we start just thinking back some of the issues we've had here, even before the first game, that sudden announcement from FIFA that there'd be no alcohol sales at the stadium. In some ways, it was well pulled off that by Qatar. You spend 12 years suggesting you will allow alcohol. You then in September finally get a policy, which is you'll have alcohol before games only and after games in the perimeter of stadiums. You know, not unreasonable compared to some of the restrictions in other parts of the world. But then with 2 days until kickoff, having already moved the stands to less prominent locations, you then say, actually, we don't want any alcohol at all. And FIFA, because of the position they're in, have absolutely no leverage at all. They can't pull the tournament. They can't move the teams anywhere. What can they say to Qatar? So Qatar has really used its leverage and power over FIFA there. And that was one of the instances. We'll get back to the silence in a moment.
Yeah, it does have the air of FIFA losing control of its own environment. The people in control of this World Cup are the Qatari royal family, and in particular Sheikh Jassim, who was a former crown prince before he abdicated the role to his brother Sheikh Tamim here, and it seems ruled by royal fiat. So this idea of the alcohol Rob just described, yep, we've decided we don't want it. And the thing is, for me, the alcohol point is not about beer. It's about changing the rules of engagement at the last minute, because supporters from all over the world have travelled to this World Cup like they do to other events. And for them, it's part of the tapestry of the tournament. Had they known, maybe they wouldn't have come to this, because everyone's lifestyle is different. But this is what they were offered, and it was kind of taken away from them. I spoke to some Mexican fans who were, they just couldn't believe it. They asked me to repeat it the night before the opening game. And then it was going across, one tapping the other on the shoulder. Have you heard about this? Because for them, it is exactly how they like to go to football. But we're here now. And there's been a lot of last minute hiccups and things like that as well. I wouldn't describe the beer thing as a hiccup, Martin, but the fan accommodation, for example, these cabins, these $200 cabins that have been built, Fans have arrived in Qatar only to find 6 or 7 hour queues at check-in because their cabins are still being painted and not ready, or going into a room and finding there's other people already in them. And that's just one thing. And then when you try to get a response, as you alluded to earlier, it's met with radio silence. And what that creates is a vacuum, and that's going to be filled.
And the issue is, the rainbow armbands issue went on, particularly this week, for days, didn't it? And then we had the issue over particularly the removal of rainbow items. Now, Qatar, there was an inconsistent message, perhaps from an interview I did back here in March, that we'd take rainbow items off fans to protect them from a security official. Then when I was here in October with Nasser Al Qatar, the CEO of the World Cup, he was insistent rainbow items would be allowed. So that's a clear position, then the everyone is welcome position. And yet there we had it on Monday when we had Grant Waller had a rainbow T-shirt on, very high profile. You think that was provocative?
Yeah, I think he was obviously doing that to make the point clear that these guys had promised this policy where rainbow items would not be allowed. And I assume he knew, or that would be allowed. I assume Grant knew that they wouldn't be allowed. Hence, he arrived at the game he went to with it on and had an issue there. Also, some fans. Martin, what's your take on it?
Somebody who's been on this program as a guest before, Laura McAllister, she had assurances from FIFA beforehand that she would be allowed to wear a rainbow hat and was then sort of prevented from doing so by security. Now, Laura McAllister actually ran for the FIFA council. She's not any sort of, she's not just a normal fan in a way. She, you know, she's an ambassador for the Welsh FA. She is a former captain of the Wales women's team. So yeah, all this, you know, she checked it out beforehand to make sure it was going to be fine to wear this rainbow hat, was given assurances and then turned up and then was basically told she wasn't allowed to. So, I mean, the organisers have got themselves completely in a twist over this.
So that was on Monday. And then I suppose what we might have expected was a very swift statement saying, of course, we've always said rainbow items would be welcome and we'll be reminding those security and steward officials at the stadiums. But it just didn't come at all. And that was something that was pretty noticeable and something I thought for some time would be the issue, that however tolerant they try to sort of insist the message was from the top of FIFA and top of the government in terms of the local authorities, that it would be very hard for that message to be transmitted, particularly when stewards, police, security are coming from all parts of the world. In, you know, got Turkey, from I think Pakistan as well, from Morocco. So it's a lot of people to transmit these messages to. But then after Monday night, we heard nothing, not a simple sort of bland sort of statement saying, of course, you know, we've always said these items would be welcome, so we've just issued that reminder. It took until the Welsh FA on Thursday announced that they'd been informed by FIFA, there'd been this assurance sent to stadiums that they would be okay to hear anything. And at the time of recording on Friday, we still actually had no official word from FIFA since Monday saying, of course, rainbow items. This was just a few stewards of events. We didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah, and in terms of the issue of the rainbow colours. And I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? This many days, we're well into the tournament. The first set of games are finished and we're still kind of stuck with this question over what's allowed in stadiums. And also, Martin, this situation with the armbands as well. And look, the seven European nations announced in September that they intended to wear this One Love armband. And for me, that is already a watered down protest. It is not the rainbow flag. It's this thing that's designed by the Dutch FA. And it seemed to be an effort at not to be too provocative towards their hosts in Qatar by having a complete rainbow armband. They were trying to thread the needle. They told FIFA about this in September. We then get to the day of the opening game. There's a meeting, a very testy meeting, between the Europeans and FIFA officials on Sunday, hours before Qatar, Ecuador opened the World Cup. Still no resolution. Then we have the English FA asking for a meeting, an emergency meeting with FIFA on Monday, just hours before they're supposed to open the World Cup against Iran. And it's there, they're told, guys, it's not going to be just a slap on the wrist or a fine, you risk a yellow card or worse, this open-ended sanction, which, to be fair, all of these teams, with England telling Belgium, Switzerland, Wales, Netherlands, Germany and the others that we can't do this now. And it's been a total fiasco, and that still hasn't been resolved. These European nations are furious. Denmark are talking about leaving FIFA, Martin.
I've seen the Germans, they had their own protests with their hands over their mouths. I'm sure other countries, including England, are going to do other things themselves. So this isn't going to go away anytime soon. And I think it's amazing the lack of response from FIFA and Qatar. I don't know, you know, I mean, I've been at every World Cup since 1998, and I cannot remember anything like this in terms of sort of blackout. It's incredible.
So the situation used to be that there were daily press conferences at the World Cup. And so in 2014 in Brazil, we had Delia Fischer, who was the press chief then, who would be asked everything. So it meant when we had the Luis Suarez bite, she was the one talking on camera, however uncomfortable that was to have to deal with all these issues. That changed in Russia in 2018. So there isn't that sort of accountability part, the ability to ask on all these issues every day, which perhaps probably suits FIFA and the local organisers, so they're not having to confront all these issues. And often on some stories, it can breathe oxygen into them. As we see at the Olympics, it can lead to strands of stories extending because actually you've got the ability to ask, in that case, Mark Adams on camera there. But this sort of silence is sort of, the void has been filled by angry, annoyed football officials. It's not the media necessarily. It's the German FA, it's the Welsh FA, it's others speaking out. And I just wonder, obviously it sort of went down to the wire a bit, but whether or not, imagine if all the players on the teams who wanted to wear the rainbow armbands just wore rainbow items themselves, and FIFA then went and punished and launched disciplinary cases against multiple teams and effectively banned, or what a global outrage that would be. There's no way they could have done that without being publicly, you know, targets of public scorn. We already saw the US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, when he was here the other day, criticizing the decision to ban the One Love armbands, even though the Americans weren't planning to.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Martin, and Rob's kind of raised that point. This idea of collective action, they've kind of folded like a deck chair really quickly, these guys. If these are seven major nations, seven of the 32 teams at the World Cup, what if they just said no? What if they maybe refused to leave the dressing room? What if they just wore the armband? It does, I don't know, no one comes out of this looking particularly good. Yes, they're all complaining and hand-wringing on the sidelines, these various FA chiefs, but they didn't really do anything. If they thought that this issue was something they really wanted to take a stand on, why didn't they do anything? I mean, I went to a press conference on Thursday, or Wednesday, sorry, with Granit Xhaka, the Swiss captain, Switzerland being one of the seven teams, and I asked a question. Granit Xhaka's father famously actually was a political activist in Yugoslavia and was jailed for that. And, you know, I mentioned that to Granit in the presser. You know, he comes from this rich heritage, given that story. And whether, given what FIFA have tried to do and clamp down on the armband protest, whether it's just he should just go ahead and do it. And he didn't answer the question, at least to me at all, and just looked at the press officer, who answered in a similar way to say FIFA have imposed this and they're very sad. And then somebody else asked, and Granit Xhaka said, look, we're just here to focus on the football now, pretty much what Gianni Infantino had asked him to do at the start of the tournament. What do you reckon, Martin?
Yeah, I think there's a lack of unity. I mean, I think if everybody had sort of gone down the same approach, then that could have worked, having the sort of collective action. But, for example, what did Eden Hazard say about the Germans when they're covering their mouths? He said, oh, look what happened to them. They went and lost the match afterwards, as though that was sort of connected. So, I think it's, once you start playing the football and people start, you know, players start thinking about getting through to the next round, then sort of for a lot of them, any sort of action demonstration is second fiddle, really, because they are focused on other things. So it's collective action only works if everybody does it together.
One of the issues is it relates to the rules of the game, the laws of the game, IFAB, which, of course, the four home nations are on the IFAB board, the other four votes held by FIFA. And there was a decision, I think, 9 years ago. Was it after, I think, Didier Drogba got booked for wearing a Nelson Mandela T-shirt tribute in Turkey, that actually suddenly there were new rules banning any form of slogans or messages at all, if it was directly linked to that, to avoid this confusion, complication over what is acceptable, what is not, to just prevent any messages being allowed. Then in 2020, when the Bundesliga resumed as the first major European league during the pandemic, following the murder of George Floyd in the US at the hands of police, we had players like Jadon Sancho wearing a T-shirt with George Floyd on it, and they got booked, which is obviously pretty shocking given the solidarity they're trying to show. And then at that point, FIFA suddenly said, they should be applying common sense, the Bundesliga. Then we had other countries. I think in England, they also said we should be applying common sense. And one of the points I raised at the time was, how is this going to work within the laws of the game? Because you need something that is more codified. How can the phrase common sense be interpreted around the world? One person's common sense is another person's offensive message.
Yeah, it is complicated. But again, the head in the sand approach from FIFA from September has allowed this problem to fester and explode at the World Cup, which is, for me, ridiculous. Had they talked to the teams from earlier, we wouldn't be in this mess. And the other thing that's happened is we've had politicians now take center stage with these armbands. For example, at Germany's opening game, the day they put their hands over their mouths to say they've been muzzled by FIFA, up in the stands, the German interior minister, who was sat next to Gianni Infantino, the FIFA president, she wore a pink suit to the stadium. She took her blazer off, and she was wearing the One Love armband, which was photographed, and those images were sent around the world. And weirdly, Gianni Infantino is seen posing with her and pointing at it as well with a curious look on his face. The next day, we have a match. I think it was at the Morocco versus Croatia game, or one of the World Cup games. We have officials from the Gulf, presumably Qatari officials, also wearing armbands, similar way to the interior minister of Germany. But this time, they were supporting Palestinian rights, and that was picked up. So are we now in a situation where, while the players are muzzled up in the VIP seats, or should we say VVIP seats, given that we're in Qatar, we're going to have Gianni Infantino or senior FIFA officials sat next to politicians making their own armband protests?
And then, and it can sound whataboutery to some, will these politicians be wearing similar protest items if they go to another country with anti-LGBT laws? And that can be in Asia, in the Middle East, in the Caribbean, Africa. It's how you apply that consistency, isn't it? And, you know, some people have been called out for that in a way. I mean, look at some of the Germany players who are protesting with their silent protest there. Some play for Bayern Munich, Manchester City. They've got sponsors from these countries. I asked the FA chief executive, Mark Bullingham, whether they'd be looking at their Emirates sponsorship again, whether they would be putting some pressure on the UAE in an interview. And, you know, he was, you know, not exactly answering. He was a bit, you know, avoiding, being very cautious to actually get into a position there. But the FA have been applying pressure on Qatar. Similarly, we had the BBC in the UK not airing the opening ceremony part of the game from Sunday night, Qatar against Ecuador, as a chance to instead show very strong reporting about Qatar, strong context about everything that's gone on here. Gary Lineker later told a show that the reason was partly corruption in Qatar. Well, actually, one of the most corrupt sporting event bids in recent years was the Tokyo Olympics, which is still rumbling on today. There was very little coverage of that around Tokyo, where we both were.
Well, I think part of the thing with this World Cup and corruption, if we want to move on to this, is it was almost known from the very beginning. This thing, 12 years, has been built on a mountain of corruption allegations that eventually, according to the US Department of Justice, at least in that 2019 indictment, actually occurred. So from the speculative elements of during the bid, why this nation at that time that would have been completely ill-suited to hosting a Summer World Cup when it bid in 2009, of all the bidders managed to win, the rumblings of corruption have been there from the beginning. And that's why this thing has been shrouded in controversy from even before they started building work. And then, Martin, we've got migrant workers and LGBTQ issues and myriad others. This thing is probably an event that under the biggest cloud and scrutiny than any I can remember.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's some things were fairly toxic occasionally around the build-up to Russia and sort of human rights issues before the Beijing Olympics, but nothing like this. That's absolutely true. Rob, you and I, we both interviewed the sports minister of Saudi Arabia this week, Prince Abdulaziz. I think we both asked him about this potential for Saudi Arabia bidding jointly with Egypt and Greece for the 2030 World Cup. I mean, I asked him directly, would he rule it out? And he said, no, basically they'll look at all opportunities. But it's an interesting one. I did also ask him, wouldn't you be deterred from bidding because of all the sort of negative publicity that's been around Qatar? And he said, no, that they're used to criticism. They expect it. They can deal with it. If that were to happen, that would open the floodgates even more so on a bid in terms of all the issues that Qatar faced.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do like the fact that we're moving on to other areas before getting on to one of the huge moments of the week, the Gianni Infantino press conference. But it's a way of teasing you all before we actually get to that. And yeah, we both had some time. I was speaking to Prince Abdulaziz out here in Doha, and he was a bit more concrete, at least discussing that potential 2030 bid in terms of the hosting. When I asked him, how could you cope given the fact you'd have Greece and Egypt involved in the bid? And he said, well, the travel distances might be shorter than the US, Canada and Mexico for 2026. We did get onto things like gay rights. And he said all fans are welcome, the sort of message we heard from Qatar. On alcohol, I did ask him, is it Islamophobic to impose alcohol on a country to force Saudi to sell drink at a World Cup? And he thought it was, because actually Qatar already has drink. So to actually ask Qatar to sell drink at stadiums isn't asking them to do something completely that they're against here, because you can drink in many, many bars in Qatar. There are a couple of shops where foreigners working here can buy alcohol, but you can't in Saudi Arabia drink anywhere. And he sort of said, well, if you don't like it, just don't come. That was his direct message. And it does raise the question, actually, is it unreasonable of FIFA to demand a dry country like Saudi, for religious reason, doesn't sell alcohol?
To be fair, I think that's exactly what the Qataris should have done. This is the issue. It's not about whether beer is sold or not sold. Had they just been clear right at the beginning that they won't be able to do this, it would have given people clarity. It's the fact that the situation kept changing in the week, in the hours before the first game. We even had the opening day of the tournament switched just 100 days before a tournament that had been in the works for 12 years. It's this, pulling the rug under from people that sticks in the craw more than most things. And Rob, yeah, the world is complex and there are going to be dry countries. Again, if you're Budweiser, FIFA's sponsor, should they not have been told before, 2 days before, Martin?
So one thinks that FIFA were sort of didn't want to lose the very lucrative sponsorship that Budweiser pays them. So actually, when the beer ban, the rumours started flying around, my colleague Owen Slot got the tip that there was going to be a complete ban in the stadium perimeters. And I checked it out and got it confirmed. And I was like, speaking to people, I say, Budweiser are going to be absolutely furious with FIFA for this. And they said, well, yeah, they're pretty unhappy, but hang on a minute, just look, the next World Cup is going to be in the USA. There's a sponsorship deal, still hasn't been signed for that. I think they can use this as leverage to make sure they get a really good deal for the USA, which is actually much more important to them than Qatar. So whether, you know, if I think legal action as a result of that would certainly have succeeded if they wanted to do it, but I don't think it's going to happen now. I think they'll do some sort of deal to get what they want for USA, Canada, Mexico in 4 years' time.
Well, we'll move on to some of the rest of Prince Abdulaziz's interview later, where we talked about Manchester United being up for sale. Another huge story in any other week, had it not been for the World Cup. But actually, picking up on that point about the United States, the World Cup in 2026, I wonder how FIFA and Gianni Infantino are thinking this week, the fact that he is a punchline on the US late night chat shows like Stephen Colbert after that press conference. So we're 25 minutes or so into this pod, and that moment, the bizarre at times press conference on Saturday on the eve of the World Cup, where Gianni Infantino opened with this.
Today I feel Qatari. Today I feel Arab. Today I feel African. Today I feel gay. Today I feel disabled. Today I feel a migrant worker.
The one thing he didn't say was, I feel journalist. How did you react in the room when he was saying that? You were just behind me.
It was jaw-dropping, really, wasn't it? And it just went on and on. I think it was 57 minutes, just under an hour of stream of Gianni consciousness. And it was a wild ride. There were so many lines there. I was just thinking, you know, how to even write this. One of the things he did, he spoke for all of that time, and then one of the lines he said, Ziggs, but I'm not here to defend Qatar. And I was like, well, you just spent an hour doing this. It was wild. And you know, some of the points, if you pass them, that he was trying to make were reasonable in amidst all of that, but it was wild. And then there was this moment, again, one of the jaw-dropping things was these kind of false equivalences of his own life as a ginger-haired kid in a school being bullied. I think he was trying to compare that to a gay person in the Middle East who is oppressed. It was really quite something, wasn't it?
Particularly so, because it was in May, I think, when he'd started to talk about him being able to feel what the migrant workers are going through here, because his own family were migrants from Italy to Switzerland. And there was criticism then at the time. It's when he also said, well, out in the States, that the workers take great pride in building up the World Cup infrastructure. And yet here he was again, using that analogy, but going even further, we're talking about, you know, red hair and bullying.
Just on the migrant point, Rob, that recall is quite important here. This was at a conference in the US where he made those comments about them feeling pride. I went to Nepal just before the World Cup to talk to workers from there who not only migrate to Qatar, but to the Gulf in order to feed their families. And I met a chap who actually helped build the Lusail Stadium, the venue for the World Cup final. And I said to him, Gianni Infantino said you should feel pride and you should be happy that you've been part of this great project. He had quite a pithy line. He said, to be honest with you, I'd be happier if I was paid a bit more. And that was the point, Martin.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's not forget, FIFA and Qatar have still, and probably never will, commit to, firstly, setting up or allowing a centre for migrant workers to be set up so that they can access support and know their rights in the future as a legacy of this World Cup. Nor will FIFA contribute anything towards a sort of compensation fund for the families of migrant workers who've been injured or killed in building the World Cup stadiums or infrastructure.
What he did vaguely commit to was a legacy fund. Actually, there's an interesting backstory to World Cup legacy funds, because if I'm remembering this right, it was 2013, we're out of the Confeds Cup and Sepp Blatter was doing a press conference, and someone actually within FIFA said, why don't you ask him about if there's going to be a legacy fund? So I used the question to ask, will there be a legacy fund, in which he commits to it then? And no one actually had heard about this thing before then. None of the finance officials. I think it did later get caught up in some of the Brazilian corruption, didn't it? Yeah, it got stuck, as Harriet points out. And then ever since then, who knows what happened to the Russian one at all. But yeah, it just reminded me of the origins of that. But yeah, we had the chance to ask Gianni Infantino, and fairness to him, he did call on some of those of us who aren't exactly necessarily easy on him. My question was actually around how can we take Qatar's word on far bigger matters about migrant worker legacy and LGBT rights, given the fact they reneged at this late stage on Budweiser and alcohol, and also asking if he was actually in control, of which, of course, he said 200%. Tariq, you asked a cheekier question, perhaps?
Well, a lot of that stream of consciousness, the 57-minute talk from Gianni, was pretty much railing on European hypocrisy as he saw it, European critics. He said, you know, Europe should be apologizing, or Europeans should be apologizing, for 3,000 years, for the 3,000 years of miseries he felt that they'd given the rest of the world. So I said, you know, Gianni has been spending a lot of time here, almost the last year, his in Qatar, pretty much living here when he's not living on an aeroplane, and his some of his children, I believe, are at school here. So I asked him, given his appeared resentment towards Europe, whether he would stay here in Qatar after the World Cup, whether this will be home for him. He seemed to suggest that, in fact, he is going to be moving to the United States of America because that's where the next World Cup's going to be run.
He didn't quite answer it like that. He did said he'd be spending more time where you're from.
Yeah, and given that I live in Hackney, we can... I don't know if we're going to see Gianni Infantino moving into a flat nearby, off Green Lanes, if you're familiar with that part of the world.
Oh, maybe the World Cup is coming to England after all. We just didn't know about it.
But, there were some, significant points he was trying to make in that press conference defending Qatar. But in doing so, did he bring more attention actually to the Qatari issues and made himself more of the news by saying so? I mean, it would not have been such a big international story. They wouldn't be playing clips of him on the US late night shows through the week if he delivered a bland press conference. But I suppose we can hardly complain, because it gave us something to talk about and huge, things to debate and discuss, and very sort of significant sound bites that we could all spin off, and social media seems to be captivated by.
Yeah, he probably enjoyed it, actually, Gianni. And I think he clearly wanted to come out fighting and use this as an opportunity to get things off his chest. But, I mean, you're right, the whataboutery and the sort of strange comparisons around his own personal experience of being bullied at school. And it just seemed so lame to me, and to, I think, a lot of people from watching it from a long way away.
There was also a real curious ending to that press conference as well, and it kind of spoke to this sense of siege within FIFA, the organization, as well, over all of this. And it was, again, completely unexpected. Brian Swanson, the communications director of FIFA, basically, it seemed on the spot, wanted to make a statement. He kind of asked for permission to his boss, Gianni Infantino, who's there to his right, if he could say some words. And Brian effectively used that platform to publicly come out as gay just the day before the opening ceremony in Qatar, in Doha. And he seemed to be saying that he was doing that to show that he felt comfortable here and comfortable with Gianni Infantino in particular, the FIFA president, who he said has only been supportive of not just him, but other gay members of staff at FIFA. And to be honest with you, I was quite surprised that that was required. I don't think anyone has suggested FIFA as an institution is homophobic or Gianni Infantino is. What did you think?
You know, if that's what Brian thought was where he wanted to make that statement, then I guess, you know, that's up to him. But if he's trying to use it as a sort of political point to show FIFA is sort of tolerant, then, I mean, as you say, the one thing that I've never thought FIFA was intolerant of anything like that. I've always actually thought FIFA has been very, very hot on equality all the way, you know, for as long as I can remember reporting on it, which is why the issue of the ban on homosexuality in a World Cup hosts has been such a big problem for them.
Yeah, obviously a very, you know, powerful personal moment for him. That was certainly well received all round. What I would say, and we had it with fan groups who've come out here in the past where they've been hosted by Qatar or certainly under their auspices, and gay fan groups, and they've sort of said they had a welcoming experience. If you are here very clearly as part of FIFA or part of a hosted experience, it would be very surprising if you were to be targeted. And I think people would say it's actually how do the locals feel, those who aren't in the spotlight, those who don't have the sort of protective cloak of being around the Supreme Committee or FIFA.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a wider issue, obviously. That an event like the World Cup, whichever country hosts it, and it's important that the 2026, the three hosts there, the US, Canada, and Mexico, will get this scrutiny on everything that's going on there. For example, another week of gun violence in the United States. Tragic and deeply depressing, that will worry supporters who are going there, and I'm sure reporters will look at that. But Qatar has its issues, one being this law that criminalizes homosexuality and human rights more generally, and also on the migrant workers, Martin, something that I just could not believe, given the headlines and the awful stories about the treatment of migrant workers here. I was walking to the stadium on the opening day, and it was about 3:30, so 3.5 hours before the kickoff for the game, and there were about 200 mainly Indian men there in the parched sun. They were there in a car park or something nearby, just furious. They'd been hired to work as cashiers on the concession stalls in the World Cup stadium. They were told that they would be working from 4 p.m., but they were asked to arrive at 9 a.m. in the morning. There was no one there to meet them. They hadn't eaten anything. They'd been given no water or toilet facilities, and they were right there. And I was thinking of the one thing, or at least one of the things you should get right, is to make sure, at least on this day, there isn't going to be this situation with migrant workers struggling in the sun.
Yeah, well, I think it illustrates perfectly why they are sort of bottom of the pile when it comes to people thinking about them in Qatar. And I think it's been like that the whole way through. And it's a really powerful story you wrote, Tarek, which I then saw then appeared as an exclusive in another in a British newspaper.
Yes, such is the way of these things.
Protective ownership of stories. There's one thing I would say also from the Gianni Infantino press conference. He talks about how Europe should be spending thousands of years apologising for what it's done for the previous 3,000 years, basically suggesting Europe is in no position to lecture, given actions around the world, was he implying? It was hard to actually discern what he was referring to, perhaps colonialism, but what it seemed to overlook, maybe because it was clunkily phrased, that Europeans can be victims of the actions of Europeans. There are victims of genocide in Europe, in the Balkans, in Nazi Germany, and people alive today who can feel that they are victims of European actions.
That's a really, really good point. And the fact that we, at least in some of the countries that we live in, we can criticize our own governments. We do, certainly in the UK. I don't think a government minister would feel very comfortable about appearing in a television interview or speaking to the press, given that it is an open media. Here, that doesn't exist. And Gianni Infantino, what he was trying to do was to muzzle criticism, I felt, in a way. It's not as if in the countries we're in and elsewhere, we can't talk about these things. So because we're in Qatar, Martin, is he saying, don't speak about Qatar, because you wouldn't do that in your own countries, or your own countries are responsible for X, Y, and Z? Surely we should be able to talk about everything.
Yeah, I think what I thought he was trying to say was, because of, you know, what the West has done throughout its history, like colonialism and perhaps he didn't specify this, but invading Afghanistan and Iraq possibly, but you know, this sort of lots of things that the Western countries have done wrong in the past, then we're hypocritical in the West if we criticize other people like Qatar, because, you know, get your own house in order first, sort of thing. But I thought that's a bit weird anyway, because, I mean, how far do you want to go back in history? Are you saying that the Germans can't say anything because of the Nazis, you know, what the Nazis did, or, you know, the Belgians can't speak about human rights because they have, you know, they had horrific actions in the Congo, you know, 150 years ago? Yes, there's plenty of stuff which Western countries have got to be ashamed about, but that doesn't mean that they can't make points about human rights in other parts of the world, surely.
And it was something that the Saudi sports minister, Prince Abdulaziz, raised, actually, when we were talking about Jamal Khashoggi, around that, talking about, actually, abuses by the United States and Israeli referenced as well. So as we perhaps move on to some of the other issues, as it came up with Prince Abdulaziz, the sale of Manchester United. We might have had done an entire episode on that in the end of the week. Finally, after 17 years of ownership, the Glazers indicating that they would be willing to sell. Although, perhaps, has Manchester United always been on the market? It's just they're just making it a very public way to perhaps attract buyers and flush out interest.
Yeah, we kind of had this sense a couple of months ago, Ziggs. We wrote, here we are at the World Cup, looks like a goal has been scored in the last minute by Iran. Mm-hmm. And that, to be honest with you, that kind of speaks to this story in a way. Manchester United being for sale is an enormous story. But the World Cup, happening in the World Cup, it kind of, certainly when you're on the ground here in Qatar, it kind of gets diluted by the World Cup itself. Just going back to what we were saying, Martin, we kind of felt this a couple of months ago. We wrote about Manchester United possibly being up for sale, and they didn't really comment much, but now it's official and it comes hot on the heels of Liverpool, the other big Northwest team, the other big global team, being put up for sale at the same time. And essentially, Martin, these two enormous sports institutions up for sale at the same time, pretty much asking for the same amount of money, this multiple billions, thanks to the $2.5 billion that was paid for Chelsea recently. And it's going to be some ride here. And it's only a small group of people, Martin, who can buy these teams, right?
I mean, I think that the fact that Liverpool made clear that they were looking for a potential buyer probably forced Manchester United out into the open, because I think the Glazers realise that sort of the time is right to cash in, I think, and they didn't want to sort of lose out to Liverpool, perhaps. If there was one, you know, there's somebody going to be throwing a lot of money around, they want to get that money, I guess. So I think that's connected. I think both the reasons why both owners are looking to sell are probably the same, but they've taken their money spinning commercial drives as far as they can get. They're not going to get any extra income from European Super League or Project Big Picture, which they hope they'll be able to do by selling their own TV rights for some of the games. So I think they think that their gravy train has come to an end. They want somebody else to sort of take the risk about whether there's going to be future growth from TV rights, maybe like a big streaming giant coming in. And I think they just think now's the time.
Well, and the question is the time for another set of investors coming from Saudi Arabia at all? It was something that we heard about when we were with Prince Abdulaziz. Sorry, if you can hear some noise in this press centre, we're watching the Iran-Wales game where Iran have just scored now in the 11th minute of injury time. And this World Cup has been all about how much time has been added on, the 100-minute match now becoming a regular occurrence as their TV viewers are given their value to ensure that actually they get match action. And as we return to, back to Saudi Arabia, as we were saying, Prince Abdulaziz saying, you know, he would welcome investors from Saudi Arabia, probably as he would be expected to do, but probably you wouldn't get the British sports minister saying that if we were to ask about a French club. Do you want some buyers from from England to buy Paris Saint-Germain, perhaps?
Well, you know what? It was interesting about this minister talking about so directly about wanting Saudi investors to buy these teams. And you say you wouldn't have a British minister saying something similar. It kind of speaks to the fact, back to the Newcastle point, that PIF, this state-owned public investment fund that owns Newcastle, is such a, it's so connected to Saudi Arabia. And it speaks to the fact that nothing can be done there, at least on a global scale, without the nod from the big man. And when we're talking about this famous declaration given by Newcastle to the Premier League that it is a separate entity and there'll be no Saudi involvement, you have this fellow, this sports minister, a member of the royal family of Saudi Arabia, saying, yeah, we'll be up for Manchester United and Liverpool and we'll own Newcastle. We might as well move the Premier League headquarters to Saudi Arabia, Martin.
Yes, although he said to me, the PIF is completely independent and unconnected to the government.
So, I did ask about this and I did say, isn't the PIF, isn't it Saudi government? He's like, no. I said, but it is headed by the Crown Prince. And yeah, he did reference the Premier League regulations, how they did get that Premier League announcement saying they were separated from the government. As we've said in the past in this pod, the PIF does exist on a .gov Saudi Arabian domain, so hardly separates itself from the government. The other thing he talked up was signing Cristiano Ronaldo. The other big story this week, the fact that Cristiano Ronaldo acrimoniously leaving Manchester United in that sort of settlement as well, all while we're in this build-up to the World Cup. So there you've got the sports minister talking up potential transfers. Again, perhaps it'd be more interesting with British sports ministers if they sort of get involved in the transfer window dealings as well.
Yeah, or, you know, if we're talking about these state entities, we've got Qatar owning Paris Saint-Germain. There's talk about, while we're here, let's talk about PSG trying to unload 10 to 15% to investors. Manchester City, this powerhouse club owned by the Abu Dhabi royal family, they have signed up Pep Guardiola for what will be 9 years, three times more than he's been at his boyhood club, Barca, and Bayern Munich. It just shows the power of state-owned entities. Martin, could you see, if football is this powerful as a tool, could you see a point where, look, others are going to be thinking, well, if we need to have some influence, the CIA or the State Department bidding for Manchester United and or Liverpool, you know, the British government thinking, look, we need to have some more influence in Africa, perhaps. Gianni Infantino's got his African Super League. Does Great Britain want to own one of the teams there? I mean, I do wonder where all of this is going to end.
Sources tell me the CIA already owns Arsenal and that's why they're top of the league.
There had to be some reason why, didn't there? Well, Martin, shame you couldn't be out here with us. Hopefully you can enjoy the World Cup from back there. Tarek, what an experience. It's very hard to believe we're actually here having covered this story for so long, the bid, the build-up, and here we are at a World Cup that has such a different feel.
Yeah, it's weird. I think for me, this is kind of shadowed more than half of my career. Even the fact that these guys who work for the Qatari then World Cup bid and are now in charge of the World Cup, we've all kind of grown up together. They've not had any other jobs. We've kind of seen this. I don't think they can believe this thing is on. It is odd. It is a weird experience to have this World Cup. It still is ridiculous that the World Cup is here. And I don't think I can be shaken from that conviction.
And just to say, keep up the good work from there, guys. Have a £12 imaginary beer outside the stadium on me. And ask a few questions at all those press conferences that you're not going to get being staged.
From here. Well, thank you everyone for listening and for bearing with us during these last few weeks. the great moment when someone came up to me at the stadium after England against Iran saying they were missing the pod. So it's always welcome to hear. And always any feedback in the more virtual form is always welcome at Sport Unlocked on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. But for now, Martin, Tarek and myself in Qatar. Goodbye.